Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, modern-day philosophers Stephen Nadler, a name familiar to these parts, and Lawrence Shapiro. The two of them, both professors in the same department of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, are out with a new book called When Bad Thinking Happens to Good People, How Philosophy Can Save Us from Ourselves. They write that there is an epidemic of bad thinking in the world today. An alarming number of people are embracing crazy, even dangerous ideas. Stephen Nadler, who's the preeminent expert in the 17th century philosopher Spinoza, the author of many books including The Best of All Possible Worlds, A Story of Philosophers, God and Evil, and The Philosopher, the Priest, and the Painter, A Portrait of Descartes, has penned this new thought-provoking book with his colleague Lawrence Shapiro, author of The Mind Incarnate and the Multiple Realization book. They join me now to talk about thinking, about modern philosophy, about how we can think better as citizens and perhaps save the country and maybe the world. Stephen Nadler and Lawrence Larry Shapiro, welcome. The book I'm holding in my hand, When Bad Thinking Happens to Good People, How Philosophy Can Save Us from Ourselves. I'll give it to you since you're the newcomer here, Larry Shapiro. What is bad thinking? Can you give a definition of bad thinking? And then one of you can take the second part of the question, which is how does someone get into the habit of bad thinking and how does someone get out of it?
So bad thinking is thinking that fails to meet certain epistemic norms, that is certain norms of that dictate how evidence should be used to justify belief or how reasoning should be used to draw conclusions from premises. And philosophers have sort of canonized certain rules for rational thought, and bad thinking is thinking that diverges from these rules. And you typically see bad thinking when people really want to believe something, and it's their desire that their belief be true that brings them to certain conclusions, rather than careful reflection on these rules of reasoning that philosophers like to talk about.
I think another name for it could just be irrationality. Bad thinking means you're not acting rationally. You're not forming your beliefs in a rational way, and you're maintaining them in an irrational manner. For example, when all the evidence is contrary to your belief, but you hold on to the belief nonetheless, that's to be irrational. How do people fall into this? Well, I think we're all hoping that it's not kind of a willful desire that, oh, let's become bad thinkers, but rather it's just a bad habit and a stubborn habit that people influenced by perhaps things they read, things they hear, and especially with the extent of social media, people just fall into this habit of perhaps believing whatever they happen to hear or read and persisting in these irrational ways of forming beliefs and holding on to them. And it's also encouraged by things like political convenience, or as Larry suggested, by what you want to believe. It's also encouraged by groupthink. If you find yourself among lots of other people who are holding on to the same beliefs as you, despite their rationality, you're probably going to find that as reinforcing your bad thinking.
So there's this example that sort of sets the tone for a lot of the book. You might know what I'm going to talk about. It's the ship owner, and it's this sort of, I guess, classic scenario. I'm imagining you two didn't invent this, although it's useful. Read a few sentences from your description in the book here, and then we can talk about it.
Well, I'm happy to describe it. You're right, Daniel, that the example isn't ours. It was an example that William Clifford introduced. William Clifford was a mathematician and a philosopher, 19th century mathematician and philosopher. And Clifford was what's known as an evidentialist. That is, he thought that no one should believe anything without sufficient evidence to justify that belief. And he uses as an example a owner of a ship who ignores the evidence that the ship that he owns is not seaworthy. And he lets the passengers sail the ship across the ocean, and of course the ship sinks. Clifford's point there is that irrational belief that's not based on adequate justification is not only a kind of rational defect, but it's a moral one as well, because it's a result of not allowing justification to drive your belief that ends up with this tragedy.
I'm curious why you picked this example and what we can learn from it, because you talk about the different kinds of results that can happen from bad thinking. Sometimes it's nothing awful, and sometimes it potentially is something awful. So how does this ship owner, who probably exists all over the world right now, how does he play into the kind of book that you wish to set out here?
Well, let's shift the example to something like COVID vaccines. We now have a wealth of evidence that establishes the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. And yet, we're finding a number of people in some states, a majority of people, refusing to take these vaccines. So they're ignoring the evidence, just like the ship owner ignores the evidence of the decrepit state of his ship. We have people ignoring the evidence of the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. And people are talking about how the Delta variant is now causing so much trouble. It's not really the Delta variant that's causing trouble. It's the lack of vaccines that are causing trouble. We wouldn't be worried about the Delta variant except for these people who are refusing to look at the evidence of the safety of the vaccine. And so just as the ship owner is guilty for allowing unjustified beliefs to end in the death of his passengers, we have people ignoring the evidence for the safety of the vaccine, and they're morally at fault because they're causing harm to those people who are becoming infected with COVID.
In this case, it's not just the people on the ship that go down. It could take the whole world with us. You know, as long as people are refusing to get vaccinated on the basis of their beliefs, misguided, irrational beliefs, this pandemic is just going to persist. And so here it's a threat to everybody and not just a small number of people who happen to get on the ship.
I wonder, when you two had the idea for this book, whose idea was it? Did one of you just call up the other and say, we got to do something about this? I mean, it's as we said before, the word alarming is on the cover, and the cover's bright red. So clearly, one or both of you was alarmed about something and said, we have to write about it. Why and how?
I think we're both alarmed, and I think many people are alarmed, and even more people should be alarmed, because and it's not just the pandemic over the past year, but I would say that over the last 5 or 6 years, during the Trump presidency, the events of January 6th, and you know, even going, we can go back to 2001, the aftermath of 9/11, where reactions were based more on hurt, on pain, rather than informed decisions. For your example, would it be a good idea to invade Iraq? Well, I think at that point, any rational decision-making would have made it clear that this is a bad idea. But the Trump presidency especially, it seemed to encourage all sorts of conspiracy theorists to come out of the closet. You have QAnon, you have the extreme and very dangerous right wing. And I'd say over the past 4 or 5 years, it's not just being alarmed, but being angry at seeing this pandemic of bad thinking threaten our democracy, our social fabric, and even our lives.
We know that conspiracy theories are very old, but how much worse do you think the internet has made the spread, the dissemination of conspiracy theories? I mean, if you look at from a point of view that you both have, the long view of history, what's different now that the internet enables people to do? I mean, it can spread like wildfire around the world, right?
Yeah, I think social media has exacerbated the situation. Ideas, whether they're rationally grounded or not, spread much more easily, more quickly, and at greater extent. And it becomes more and more difficult for people to decide whether what they're reading is legitimate or not. And I think as well that without, you know, in given the prevalence of social media, what we need is a kind of reform in education, which teaches young people not just whatever it's been teaching them in the past, but how to lessons in rationality, how to determine whether the evidence you're being presented with is good or bad. I also want to say that going back to your previous question, you asked, you know, did we feel like we had to do something? As philosophers, you know, there's not a lot we can do. So we felt that writing this book was the least we can do. Perhaps it's the most we can do. And we do hope that the people who most need to read this book will somehow, if not get their hands on it, at least have some friends give them, you know, pass along the message.
Well, it's something I was thinking about, which is no matter how good this book may be, no matter how sound your arguments and your reasoning may be, can it do much good if it's only being read by people like you, by maybe people like me or people listening to this? I mean, if people truly believe that global warming doesn't exist, or at least it's not caused by humans, if people truly believe that a vaccine is so dangerous and so damaging that it would be better not to take it and take your risk at getting COVID and seeing what happens, do you really think they're going to pick up this book and read it?
That's a tough question, Daniel. It's hard to say. I'm related to some of these people who refuse to tailor their beliefs to the evidence, and I have conversations with these people. And the idea is that we're trying to create something that can sort of increase the exposure of what it is to reason well. And the book, we're hoping, even if people don't read the book, they'll see reviews of the book, they'll read op-eds about the book that we've been writing. And our hope is to reach some of these people. And then if we can reach some of these people, maybe they'll reach some people as well. But as philosophers, the most we can do, and as Steve was saying, the least and perhaps most we can do, is throw out there into the public some discussion of how to think well and some discussion of why certain ways of thinking are bad. If we just reach a few people, I think that's a mark of success.
Indeed. You know, I'm curious, going back to my original question, which was a three-part question. So we talked about bad thinking, what it is, sort of, but how does someone go from bad thinking here and there to sort of having it take over their lives, right? There's a progression here. And then the next thing is bad behavior that comes after bad thinking, which you have a whole chapter on.
Right.
But what is the progression? Is it that someone sees something online and they say, that sounds a little wacky, but who knows? There's a lot of things on the internet, and you know, Tom down the street, he mentioned something like that recently too, and maybe there's something to it. Is it starting like that?
I think part of the problem anyway, is that the internet allows you to enter these closed echo chambers where you're surrounded by people who believe the same thing you do. And then we have instances of what in the book we describe as a confirmation bias, where everyone enters one of these groups, these chat groups, these Facebook groups, with certain beliefs. And because they're only associating with people who share that belief, they're only going to look at the evidence that favors the belief that they choose to have, rather than considering evidence that might challenge their beliefs. And so the internet is just a breeding ground for bad thinking, for people, it gives people an opportunity to join societies, to associate only with those people who share their ill-gotten conclusions.
In a way, it is very much like a virus. It spreads and infects people and causes them not so much to feel sick, but to think bad things and think irrationally.
The chapter that's called When Bad Thinking Becomes Bad Behavior, I wonder why you felt like you had to write this chapter, because it's a big jump from someone sitting at the internet, sort of on the computer, reading these conspiracy theories or something like that, and you know, maybe in a Facebook closed group circulating messages. There's a big difference between that and causing outward harm to the world. Where does that come from?
Well, it's not that big of a jump if you just think about what happened on January 6th. These people were riled up. Most of them never met each other in person, but as these websites and other forms of social media stirred up their passions, their beliefs got transformed into very dangerous and harmful actions. And again, as well with the vaccines, it's one thing to believe that the vaccines are dangerous, which that's bad enough, but then to refuse to take vaccines puts everyone else at risk. So I think it's a very fine line between belief and action in that case.
What if you educate us a bit about the history of all this? Go a little deeper into some examples that you draw on when you look to write this book. Obviously, there's a long tradition of philosophers who write about the kind of thing that you're writing about here. I mean, we're not unique in a position in 21st century America, although with the internet, certainly it perhaps is more volatile. But I'm curious about, what's the background here? What's the history? You mentioned Descartes a lot in the book. You mentioned other people as well. Connect it to some of the figures that you study.
So I'll say, Steve's the historian between the two of us, but I will say that part of philosophy is defined by its content, the sorts of problems and issues that it's concerned with, questions about virtue and the examined life and knowledge. But in addition to this content, philosophy is often concerned with method, where method involves how to think, how to reason. So some of the philosophers we talk about, at least in the first few chapters of the book, are people like Francis Bacon, who was very concerned with thinking about how science can progress and what sort of methods of reasoning can actually give us knowledge of the world. And then we move on to other philosophers like Descartes and Spinoza, and preceding these people, of course, are figures like Aristotle and Plato. Aristotle deserves credit for actually trying to formalize certain rules for deductive reasoning. So philosophy has always been interested in methods for thinking. And now I'll let Steve speak more about the modern philosophers.
Well, I was going to suggest that if you just think of any of the horrendous acts or events or practices or institutions of history, behind it, you'll find some form of bad thinking. The enslavement of other human beings, the morally abominable way in which we treat non-human animals, the Inquisition in Spain, all of these in some way are founded on beliefs that really have no justification about racial inferiority and so on. So I think bad thinking is not just an acute event that happens at particular moments, but it's there throughout history. And in terms of modern philosophy, I think most of the great philosophers who I admire see themselves as progressive in the sense that they're trying to correct moral error, political error, and especially the irrationality that tends to lie behind these. Descartes, for example, was out to reform what he took to be misguided and unjustified beliefs about the natural world and about the human being's place in the world. An even better example is Socrates, who saw that his fellow citizens of Athens did not put the right value on the right things. And this led them to into war. It led them into enslaving other human beings. And for him, the most important way he could devote his life would be to go around Athens and showing people that all those beliefs that they thought were justified were in fact not, that they really didn't know what they were thinking, they really didn't know what they were doing, and they were leading what he called unexamined lives. He saw that as a kind of heroic enterprise, and he compared himself to the great Homeric heroes at Troy. It's just that his courage was devoted not to a violent activity in a military context, but, as he says, to making other people into better citizens.
What do you mean, the right things and the wrong things, according to Socrates? Just tell us exactly what that means. What are the right things to be devoted to, and what are the wrong things to be devoted to if you're Socrates?
Well, the examples he picks out are these. The wrong things is to devote your life in pursuit of wealth and honor and political power. And what makes them wrong is that, at least in his view, they're harmful. They don't do good for you. The other problem with them is that the more you pursue these things, the more futile your projects are going to be, because acquiring honor or wealth or power and such is, whether you succeed or not, is not really under your control. There are so many factors of contingency. The good things, the right things to pursue, are those things which make you into a better person. They improve you as a knower. They improve you as a moral agent. And the kinds of things that do this, that bring about these improvements in you, knowledge, especially self-knowledge and understanding, the acquisition of these things, unlike wealth or power or honor, is totally under your control. It's up to you whether you're going to become a better person through the pursuit of a better, through reflection and a better understanding of who you are and what you know.
It seems to me that the term you use, bad thinking, is a little light, a little milquetoast when it comes to the behavior of some people. When does what you call bad thinking become evil doing? You avoid this word a lot, but at some point you have to say what someone is doing is evil.
I actually prefer the word stupidity, but our publisher didn't think that having stupid in the title would do much for convincing people of our lessons.
Steve and I have a disagreement about that. So I think a lot of the bad thinking that we find in the world today is not the same as stupidity, or at least we can say that it's not stupid people involved. Often the conspiracy theorists who are the sort of antithesis of good thinkers are not stupid. They're very clever. They, if you read some of the arguments for why the Earth must be flat rather than spherical, they're not stupid. They're quite clever. It just is they're based on all sorts of false assumptions or poor reasoning, but they're not stupid. Back to your question, not all bad thinking, as Daniel, you said already, is harmful. But when you combine bad thinking with bad behavior, with behavior that potentially brings a great deal of harm, that's where we see the real need for remediation.
Although I would say there is a harm in bad thinking itself, and that and this is a point Socrates makes, you're harming yourself. That is, you're not flourishing as a rational agent. You're not, to use a term that seems to be popular among millennials, you're not living your best life.
Heard that one before.
Yeah.
What if you are living your best life and you just don't give a shit what you just said, Stephen Nadler? I mean, what if to you that's it?
Well,
your best life.
If that's your view, if you're kind of subjectivist about what counts as a good life, then, as we say in Yiddish, geh gesund, you know, good for you, go ahead if you're happy. But I do think, I believe at least, I don't know if Larry agrees, that there's an objective way in assessing whether a person is leading maybe not the best life that they want to lead, and that is in their conception of what counts as a good life, but I think there are, objectively speaking, better and worse lives. I think as rational beings and as moral agents, it's incumbent upon us to use our faculties to the best of our abilities and try to improve those faculties and our abilities and become better human beings. And I think there are objective ways of assessing whether a person is a good or bad person. I don't think living your best life is a totally subjective matter.
I do agree with that. We have one of the examples in our book is we say, imagine a thoroughbred horse that was sort of born to run, spending its life in a stable. There's something tragic about this majestic, glorious animal that it's never allowed to use its talents. And human beings have talents. We're born with powers of reasoning that go beyond the sorts of powers of reasoning that most non-human animals have. And to spend your life in front of a TV set playing video games is like that thoroughbred that spends its life in a stable. It's not living to its potential. And that, I think, is a real loss.
You know, I'm curious about how you come together to write this book, because obviously you're two different people. You do different things professionally. You're both in the field of philosophy broadly, but you may agree on the overall picture, but there must have been points of disagreement. You just highlighted one. I'm curious, what other things did you fight about? Fighting and arguing are central to philosophy. They're also central to Judaism, but when it comes to coming up with something, you're not the same person. What do you feel passionately differently about that maybe didn't come out in the book?
But there really was not a lot of argumentation in writing the book. You know, we each took primary responsibility for different chapters, and then we'd send the chapter to the other person. And there was a little back and forth in terms of revising, but on the basics, we were pretty much in agreement. The thing is, we do spend a lot of time together. We go running and cycling together quite often, and that gives us a chance to hash out a lot of the issues. If there's a difference between us, I would say that I'm probably a little more tolerant of people who are religious and religiously observant than Larry is. I would call myself an atheist, but I think I have a great deal of respect for people who are religious when that religion itself informs their good behavior and their good thinking. I think of, you know, people in the Jewish, Christian, Islamic, and other traditions, people like Dorothy Day and the Berrigan brothers, who inspired the Catholic worker movement, for example. You know, and of course, religion has led to a great deal of harm and abhorrent behavior. I don't think that would be an instance of good thinking.
Larry, if Steve Nadler is an atheist who's tolerant of religious folk, what are you? Where do you come down on religion, and how much harm do you think religion does on a daily basis?
I wouldn't say that I was intolerant of religion. I've written this other book called A Miracle Myth, in which I talk about why belief in miracles is unjustified. That doesn't mean I don't think people should give up their religious convictions. It just is they should recognize that these religious convictions are not rational in an epistemic sense, that is justified by evidence or reason. But I'm not saying that people who believe in God, believe in miracles, should stop believing these things. They should just recognize that their belief isn't based on rational argumentation. Now, to the second part of your question, what harm does religion do? Well, I think religion can do a lot of good. It's certainly a source of comfort for a lot of people. And it's also, when Jesus's teachings are actually practiced, I've got no problem with that at all. The idea that we should love one another, that we should be charitable, that we should care for the worst off, that's all religious dogma, and I'm in favor of that. It's when religion turns in other sorts of directions and you get people saying that for religious reasons, women shouldn't have a right to abort an unwanted fetus, say, or for religious reasons, gay people shouldn't be allowed to get married. That's when I think religion starts doing harm.
I think Spinoza got it right when he said that, well, true religion is just knowing how you should treat other human beings and why you should treat them with love, justice, and charity. And the person who is truly religious is the person who, with full understanding, behaves in that way, and whose actions and whose life is informed by certain charitable and just values.
How closely tied, I wonder, is a sense of deep religiosity, or at least professed outward religiosity, and bad thinking? And this is something you touch on near the beginning of the book, and you make some ties, for example, between people who are anti-vax and where they fall on the religious and the political spectrum. What do you think? What do you lay out here?
Well, as Larry said, as long as they realize that their religious faith is just that, faith and not rational knowing, I don't think it's necessarily bad thinking at all. It's the mistake they make, well, several mistakes that religious people can and do make. One is seeking to impose their religious beliefs on others, contrary to what the others, contrary to the will of the others. I think that's just bad acting informed by bad beliefs, but also to fail to distinguish between religious beliefs and moral beliefs. It's one thing to believe on religious grounds something about abortion or something about same-sex relationships. And if you recognize that that's a religious issue, fine. That's, you know, you might be wrong, but fine. And hopefully we can correct their beliefs about that when we find them morally acceptable. But that's religious belief. And the danger comes in thinking that religious belief is also moral belief. There's absolutely no relationship whatsoever between religious, let's say, religious values and moral values, except when they happen to coincide. So, for example, if you are against same-sex relationships because you believe God has forbidden them, well, then what you're really talking about there is piety. That is, it's a religious belief. It's not a moral one. And to recognize the difference between doing something because God wants you to do it and doing something because you recognize it to be right. Those are two very different things. And I think one of the great problems in the world today is that people confuse religious piety with moral right and wrong.
Talk about this akrasia. I'll just read a couple sentences from the chapter When Bad Thinking Becomes Bad Behavior. The title of this section is Why Should I Do It? The problem of akrasia or weakness, why would a person act contrary to his better judgment and fail to do what he knows to be right, should be distinguished from a related but nonetheless different problem, the problem of motivation. In the problem of motivation, the question is whether it is possible to know the right action and yet not be motivated to do it. With weakness, the assumption is that the person is motivated to do what is right. Medea feels the pull of duty to her father and a desire to submit to his authority, but this motivation gives way to an opposing impulse. By contrast, one might wonder whether a person can know the right course of action but still ask, "Why should I do it?" A failure to act in accordance with moral duty might arise not because of a failure to see the right action, nor because the desire to take this action is weaker than some contrary desire, but simply because of a lack of desire or motivation to do what is right. Is this an instance of bad thinking? It depends. Well, what does it depend on? Explain this.
So the case of akrasia or weakness, I think the best case that Larry and I face every year are students who know they ought to study on Thursday night because there's an exam on Friday, and they want to succeed on that exam. And so somewhere in there is a desire to study, but it's overcome by the desire to go out and party, which would be a stronger, more passionate desire. That would be akrasia or weakness. But the person who, let's say, walks by a lake and there's somebody out there drowning and they refuse or fail to go out and help that person, not because they recognize that they should, but they're afraid of their ability or because of some other competing desire, but they ask, why should I help that person? That would be somebody who simply is not motivated to do the right thing, despite seeing that it's the right thing. It's often bad thinking when the failure to do the right thing comes because the person hasn't fully thought through what it is they should do. They don't consider what the right action would be in the situation, or they fail to size up the situation in the proper way. Aristotle, who is probably our earliest and one of our most important thinkers on weakness, suggested that behind all such failures to act rightly, to follow through on one's better judgment, is some kind of failure of thought, either not attending to all the factors that are relevant to the situation or not performing the proper reasoning to draw the right conclusion about what you should do.
What if it's just by chance? What if someone doesn't even go that deep in terms of not thinking about everything? I mean, because how much time is someone supposed to spend thinking about all the different scenarios to make a decision? What if it's just a decision someone makes on the fly and based on all the information they have at the moment, but they haven't researched deeply and read deeply and asked every smart friend they have? How far is someone supposed to dig before they know they found enough information to make the right decision?
Well, let me ask you two questions. First, in this situation, do they have the time to dig a little deeper? And secondly, is there a reason why they fail to do so? Is there some competing motive? Are they afraid of what they might figure out?
Well, they have the time, but perhaps they thought they found a good enough solution and they have a busy life and they need to move on.
Yeah, sometimes that's going to be the case. And sometimes we have to act instinctively, or even we don't have time to get additional information, or perhaps that additional information is just not readily available. If in those cases, if the person feels that they've done the best they could do, then I think that that's certainly an extenuating set of circumstances. On the other hand, let's say they fail to do the action that they could have done, and there's a feeling of regret there. We all think of the ending of Schindler's List, where he keeps going, "I could have saved more. I could have saved more. I could have done more." I think very often the key indicator here is, does the person feel like they acted rightly? And if not, are they sufficiently reflective to ask themselves, what else could I have done? Are there feelings of regret or pangs of conscience?
We also have to recognize that some decisions are more momentous than others. A decision not to take a vaccine, when we know the harm that failure to take the vaccine can do, is much more momentous than a decision not to have a cup of coffee in the morning. So we have to think about, we have to sort of do some balancing and ask ourselves, what are the consequences of a bad decision in the present context? And once you start thinking about that question, I think it becomes clearer when it's obligatory to do the sort of necessary homework you need to do to make a good decision.
One thing I think a lot of people are going to be thinking about if they hear this conversation is how they can do a little better in their own lives, because everybody has hopefully the desire to do a little better each day, maybe get a little smarter each day if possible, and read a little or have a better conversation than they did the day before. So there's a chapter here, The Philosophical Life. And I wonder if you just look at it practically, what each of you would recommend become a self-help. Well, I guess this book actually is a bit of a self-help book in a way. What do you think we can all do better at when we go through our daily lives?
There are ways to avoid misinformation. I think it's good if you turn off Fox News, and it's good if you stop getting your news from Facebook. These are notorious sources of misinformation. And on the other hand, there's things like long-form journalism. There are reputable news sources. There are books to read and lots of exposure to philosophy. The earlier, the better. Couldn't hurt. So I think a sense of what to avoid and what to pursue is a step toward good thinking.
But let me push back on one thing you just said, because you mentioned before that you have family members who are on the anti-vax train or whatever, maybe on the conspiracy theory train. What do you say if you said that to them? Turn off Fox News, pretend they said, well, CNN's no different, it's just as bad. What do you say?
I sort of agree with that. CNN seems to be... it may not be as full of misinformation and certainly not as full of harmful information as Fox News. But in general, these news sources that try to summarize and encapsulate difficult, complex issues in 3-minute news stories are inadequate. You're not a responsible citizen if your worldview simply spoon-fed to you in these bite-sized bits. So I would encourage people, and as I encourage my my family members who buy into conspiracy theories, not to get all their news from a single source, to read widely, and to think carefully about issues. It's always good, I think, it's always good practice when you hear something, some claim, some argument, to ask, what would it take to convince me that this is wrong? And then to start looking for contrary views, and then to balance these opposing views in ways that help you see through these issues.
Daniel, to go back to your earlier question, this is not something that not everybody can do. It's there. You don't need a lot of time, and you don't need a lot of energy, and you don't need a great deal of intelligence to just show a little skepticism once in a while when you first encounter a piece of information and ask yourself, why should I believe this? Should I believe it?
I have an example. Steve and I have started to benefit from hate mail already. And one person said, you know, if you take the vaccine, you're going to carry 252 times the viral load than if you don't take the vaccine. And so I wrote this guy. I said, why do you think that? And he said, well, look, I read it here. And so I looked at where he'd read it. And indeed, the website said that people who have been vaccinated carry 252 times the viral load of unvaccinated. And they cite in support a paper from Lancet, which is, of course, a very prominent, well-regarded medical journal. And so I looked at the Lancet article, and it said that people with the Delta variant carry 252 times the viral load as those without the Delta variant. It didn't say anything about vaccinated versus unvaccinated. So this conspiracy news site just picked up a fact. Well, it wasn't a fact. It misunderstood, or probably deliberately, this prominent outlet, Lancet, and their findings. And this guy, rather than looking at the actual paper, just took the word from this news source, which proudly claimed on its lead that it was the kind of news source that no one in the mainstream would accept because they were espousing the truth, which would be harmful to Big Pharma and all this kind of stuff.
It's worth pointing out, too, that the subject line in his email to us was idiots. So
with exclamation points.
So, you know, at a certain point, you got to say, oh, shut the fuck up.
Okay, but let's someone like that, you can say shut the fuck up to. What about someone like Steve Bannon? He's harder to say that to. Steve Bannon is not a stupid person, and yet he espouses some of the most harmful ideologies that make their way around the internet that one can espouse. And there's nothing stupid about this person. What do you call Steve Bannon? Is it just bad thinking? Is that your only description of him?
Well, who knows what's going on in that head of his? My assumption is that it's not bad thinking, but smart cynicism. Who knows? You know, you take the case of Trump or Bannon or people like that. You have to ask, well, what do they really believe, and how much of it is bullshit that they're using for their own cynical purposes, political gain, financial gain, and so on? You never really know when a person sincerely believes these some of the unjustified things that come out of their mouths, and when they're just using them for their own devious purposes.
Going back to something I said earlier, it just seems to me the bad thinking is a nice term up to a point. And then at a certain point, when you look at the harm someone has done, don't you have to switch it to evil or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's certainly a difference. There's a difference between those people who inadvertently engage in bad thinking and those people who embrace bad thinking as a means to promote their self-interest. Socrates, if we can take it back to Socrates, recognized the difference between wisdom and philosophical thought and the sort of rhetoric in which the Sophists were a school of Greek thinkers who emphasized the power of rhetoric to gain what they want, to serve their own ends. And rhetoricians, Sophists, were expert at convincing people with all sorts of arguments, many of which exhibited bad thinking, in order to get their way. And so I would say that Bannon is probably a modern day sophist. He's able to manipulate the way people think for his own ends.
And I think there is something evil about that. Yeah, I call it the Dick Cheney theory of truth. If you say it often enough with the right frame, with the right tone of voice, and with the right sneer on your face, it must be true.
Well, that's chilling indeed. I wonder, you know, take us into the classroom for a moment. You two both teach, you interact with students. How open are your students when it comes to being transparent with what they believe? If you have a student who only watches Steve Bannon and only listens to Alex Jones, is he going to raise his hand and tell you?
I've had, I liked how you chose a male personal pronoun, because it almost is inevitably a male student who will raise his hand and parrot something that he's heard on conservative radio or conservative TV. You could use these as teaching moments. It's not my teaching style to simply just correct the person. In fact, I'd be worried in today's climate to promote any sort of political view myself. But you can ask other students what they think of this comment. You can ask the student who's made the point originally why he believes what he believes, and you could turn it into a conversation that is a real learning opportunity.
That's absolutely right. I mean, going back to talking about what do you do with family members who are espousing ridiculous ideas, or students who come up with those sorts of claims in class, the proper response to make to them, and this I think is one of the lessons of the book, that you should ask not just of other people, but of yourself. The proper response to make them is a very simple one. You always ask, why do you believe that? And they'll say something, and then you say, well, why do you believe that? And you know, it starts to look like a child's game. I know you are, but what am I? But in fact, what you're trying to get people to do is to reflect on the reasons why they believe things. So I think to ask, why do you believe that, is perhaps the most effective response we can have to this, in this pandemic of bad thinking.
You talked about early childhood education as being the time to address all of this, and there would be some revamping of some curriculum, something like that. What do you mean? What has to be taught that isn't being taught? What do you propose? I mean, you don't teach kindergarten, you two, but where does it start?
So one thing you do teach in elementary school is mathematics. I have a daughter who's a first grade teacher, and she goes through rudimentary mathematics with her class. And you could also just as easily go through rudimentary rules of reasoning. In fact, in college, when students are exposed to critical thinking courses for the first time, they learn about certain very common fallacies, where a fallacy is a violation of a rule of reason. And equipped with knowledge of fallacies, what a professor will often do is have students read opinion pieces in newspapers and identify various fallacies. And learning these fallacies is not a difficult task. It's something, in fact, that I think students of the age where they're just learning to read are capable also of learning to identify certain fallacies.
I mean, one thing we don't want to do is encourage children to start saying to their parents at the dinner table, that's fallacious. I think that would be, that's not what we're looking for. But, you know, the lessons of philosophy, whether we're talking about reasoning, basic formal reasoning, logic, or even lessons of moral philosophy, they're not that difficult and they're not that hard to make accessible to young minds. Think of the now well-known, perhaps overused, but nonetheless very useful trolley problem. I think you could give that to a five-year-old and they'd start to see various ways in which one can think about the best solution to that moral dilemma.
In fact, there are now programs, philosophy for kids programs, where often grad students might be involved with elementary school teachers teaching philosophy through the kinds of moral dilemmas that often provoke deep thought on these complicated issues.
You know, you finish up the book in not a very positive way. You say here, the very last paragraph, what then accounts for epistemic stubbornness? Why do we refuse to engage in the kind of rational accountability that could save us from ourselves? Is it emotion, ideology, efficiency, laziness, insecurity? Has natural selection shaped us in ways that make poor reasoning as irresistible as the sweet and fatty foods responsible for escalating rates of diabetes, obesity, and other afflictions? These are questions for psychologists to answer. What is clear is that unless we can turn things around and become epistemically more responsible in our beliefs and, more generally, commit ourselves to living examined lives, the health of our minds, of our bodies, of our democracies, and of our planet are in grave danger.
You thought that was a sad ending, Daniel?
Well, maybe I misread it, or maybe there's an asterisk that leads to another page where you sort of turn things around. But I couldn't find that. So ending on a bit of a down note. But you certainly do give us a lot to think about. It's a tall order. You're basically saying everything has to be reversed from 50% of the population, or we're screwed. You can't think that's possible, right?
We very much do. I think we are deeply concerned. It's not a hopeless situation. Otherwise, we wouldn't have written the book. There has to be some hope that we can turn things around. But I think it would have been a false note to end on a highly optimistic vision of our future, given what we're seeing in the world around us. Denial of climate change, refusal to get vaccinated, assaults on the United States Capitol, continued bad thinking and cynical manipulation by the Republican Party, by other anti-democratic parties around the world. I think something serious is needed here. So, it would have been a false note for us to have ended on a highly optimistic and sunny conclusion.
You know, things are dire when you really have to do philosophy.
How I want to finish is maybe just zooming out, because we're talking about sort of an American-focused situation, but is this all very common around the world? Do you study what's happening around the world? There is all this stuff in Germany and in Hungary, obviously all over the world, right? There's conspiracy theorists, quote-unquote, every place, right? This is not an American phenomenon. Is it worse here?
It's absolutely not an American phenomenon. It's a worldwide phenomenon. You pointed out Germany, where a frighteningly large number of members of the police and military have turned out to be devoted to far right conspiracy theories. Hungary is a clear example of a case where democracy is under threat through not just bad leadership, but by bad thinking. I think it's prevalent, and that's part of why I end the book on a note of concern, not just for the fate of politics and the fate of society, but for the fate of the planet. As long as we continue to burn fossil fuels at the rate and deny that climate change is real, this is not just an American phenomenon. Until we take drastic steps to reverse not just our behavior, but our way of thinking about ourselves and about the world, we're deeply concerned.
We can also point out that being a superpower, much wealthier than just about every other country, Americans have more ready access to information that they need to make wise decisions. And the country, because, as I mentioned, of its wealth and its power, is in a position to do more good or to do more harm than most other countries.
On the note that hopefully we can all take away at least the desire to want to do a little better, that's about the most we can hope for. Larry Shapiro, I thank you so much for being here. And it's a thought-provoking and an alarming book, and I guess that's why it's bright red.
Yeah, thanks for the nice questions, Daniel.
And Stephen Nadler, great to have you again, and nice to hear you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Daniel.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.